You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Now have a little listen to the Blind Boys of Alabama, folks. We'll be right back with Monsignor Fred Dolan, Vicar of Opus Dei Canada. Folks, I know there are a number of people out there who are wondering about what this Opus Dei stuff is all about, and this day and age, anything that seems sinister, or if we use the word sinister or secretive, people get all ramped up about stuff. And then, of course, the Da Vinci Code came along and shot these folks into stardom. I don't know whether they were ready for it or not, but they used it as an opportunity to clear up who they really are, and I think that was a wise move. Joining us in the studio is the Vicar of Opus Dei Canada, Monsignor Fred Dolan. And he's such a laid-back cat, I think he's okay with everyone calling him Fred.
Exactement. Great to be here, Drew.
Thank you. I guess the first time I came across you and what you were all about was I think it was this past Easter in the National Post, you had written an article and John Moore had written an article.
Exactly.
And I read them both and I thought, well, that was a great dialogue. Especially around that time of the year, you know. I had John Moore on the show last week, and he spoke very highly of you, and still does, of course. And somebody else who spoke quite highly of you is a gentleman named Michael Corrin,
yes.
Also a broadcaster. So there's all these people out there that like you. So how come you're the head of an organization that many people are freaking out about if you're such a likable cat, man?
That's a great question, Drew. You know what's happening is that this is giving us the chance to talk to people, to tell them exactly what we are and what we stand for and what we do. When people find out that's the real thing, they say, this is it. They say, this is it. So the whole Dan Brown, that whole
Da Vinci Code thing,
that whole experience was one person told us, you know, as his mother told him when he was growing up in Brooklyn, if life hands you a lemon, just go out and make lemonade. Hmm. So we just, what we try to do is just say to them, our message is how to take your faith and your work, everything you do every day, and then weave them together so that they be one. And that's the whole thing.
Well, let me read from your site. Opus Dei is a Catholic institution founded by, now I'm going to not pronounce this name correctly, so I'll give it my best shot, Saint Jose Maria Escriva.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. Its mission is to help people turn their work and daily activities into occasions for growing closer to God, for serving others, and for improving society. That sounds pretty harmless.
That's pretty well put.
So the whole image of the self-flagellating albino psychopath in Dan Brown's movie, when you saw the movie, when you read the book, I'm sure there must have been a lot of eye-rolling for you when they tried to represent you in weird ways.
Well, you know, when we first saw that, we stared at each other saying, what did we do to deserve this? And we were just nice people doing good things. And then we talked to a few experts in communications, and they said, who knows why he picked on you, but just run with the ball.
Sure.
Take advantage of it.
Sure. Okay, well, let's clear this up, what the difference between an Opus Dei Catholic and a Catholic is. What's the difference?
You know, Opus Dei is part of the Catholic Church. What we do is we try to help people go deeper in their faith, whether they be Catholic or not.
But Catholic Church does that, don't they?
Well, you know, we have a specific spirituality, an approach that is eminently lay, meaning that for the man and woman on the street, just everyone, just like yourself, and we say to them, it is through your work, the things that you do every day, whatever you're doing, that is where God wants to find you. And we just pound away at that. We give coaching in different ways. So we're very, very focused. we don't take the place of parishes. We are like a supplement.
Are you extreme right? Are you the conservative? Or no. I mean, because outsiders, like the evangelicals, don't understand that there's actually liberal Catholic factions and conservative Catholic factions. Mm-hmm. Where are you in that gamut?
You know, I never like to talk in those terms because that makes it so political. So in our, what we do is we just say, let's just take the teachings of the Catholic Church and let's, on a regular basis, study them, figure out how to apply them to your daily life. And so those people who come to us, we say to them, come if you want the personal coaching, the spiritual direction, the classes, courses on different things. We'll give you that, and then you go back to your own parish or your environment and then just try to put that into effect.
Right. Okay, so again, let me just try to understand. There is the Catholic Church, in within the Catholic Church, there are different factions. You are one. Why would someone who's a Catholic decide, you know, I need to be not just a Catholic, I need to be part of Opus Dei? What's the transition in their head?
I think
they want to take it more seriously? They want to ramp up their spirituality? What is it?
That's a good way to put it. I think what they do is they find that our spirituality just rings a bell. It vibrates with them.
Why?
Because I'll give you an example. Hmm. Somebody went recently to visit a friend, saw on the coffee table a book about Opus Dei, basically talking about the spirituality of work. And while he was waiting for his friend, he leafed through it and he said, oh my gosh, this means that I don't have to reserve my faith for going to church on Sunday. I can be living my faith, talking to God and turning everything I do into work.
So you help people take their faith 24/7.
That's a great way to say it. That's exactly it.
Do you find that lacking in the overall Catholic Church, that it becomes a Sunday only or Saturday only or a Mass only kind of a thing?
Not really, but it could be, because you go into any typical parish, you have 2,000 families. There's only so much that people can get there on a typical basis.
Right.
And there's very little chance for individual attention because it's just physically impossible. And furthermore, the typical parish priest is not trained to give that kind of spiritual direction. Whereas we, the 2% of the members of Opus Dei who are priests, that's all we do, is give that the spiritual direction, the retreats, days of recollection. And then the lay people of Opus Dei who have the training for this, they also do that. So we are just, you could say, super focused on this.
Okay, well, all the terms that you have, we've got vicar. Are you a father too? This is radio, and they don't understand that Fred is sitting here in traditional garb, yep. Black shirt, white collar, black pants. Right, so you get the white collar. We call it the dog collar.
Exactly.
What titles come with the way you're dressed and what you do?
Well, everybody calls me Father Fred.
Okay, so Father Fred is normal.
Yeah.
Father Fred, in this day and age, I'm not sure I would be walking around in that garb. Right? Because you, seriously, with all the pedophilia accusations and realities and truths and mistruths and whatever else is out there, there is a different reaction to the caller these days. Don't you think?
And yet, you know, I really do find, just on this trip these past days, I live in Montreal, I get smiles everywhere. I think, you know, people realize, okay, we're talking about a very small percentage of people, of priests who've been accused and convicted of this. The poor things. But they're victims especially. But that doesn't mean that's it for the priesthood. That means what we have to do is purify and eradicate this problem. But in the meantime, what I do, what I'm trying to say with this going around like this, is I exist in order to serve everybody. So I want everyone to know I'm a Catholic priest, and you would be amazed. It'd be great for you to follow me 10 feet away behind me and see how many people stop, ask for prayers, for advice, or they just want to talk. They just somebody to talk to.
I did an experiment when I was in Australia for 5 years. I was an associate pastor at a church there. I still shake my head and wonder why did they ever hire me. And on my flight back, my family had already gone ahead of me. On my flight back, I flew home with a dog collar on. And I wanted to see people's reaction. Just a social experiment, okay? And this is what I found. People were very friendly, but a tad aloof. In other words, they recognize the caller, a little polite smile, or if you, but it, God forbid if you sat beside the caller, oh, it would a little bit of a fluffy conversation, and then okay, that's it. I don't come any closer. We're done. Okay, thank you very much. So, friendly but aloof. Mm-hmm. But you're saying that this day and age, still, you're having people come right up to you and just dive right into their spiritual stuff? Is that it?
Yeah. I was on a bus recently, and someone sat down, and we chatted, and at the end, this person said, do you find that people start talking to you? I said, sure do.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, just in case you're tuned in, folks, we are sitting here in studio with Father Fred Dolan, or Monsignor Fred Dolan, Vicar of Opus Dei Canada. And, of course, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code did more to sort of arouse suspicion and curiosity about this apparently secretive and sinister group. So we're going to dive into what they are about and what they're not about on this segment of the show. How does someone join? Are there steps that you have to go through in order to join? First of all, you have to be Catholic, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have to be Catholic for a certain period of time? Can you be a rookie Catholic person and become an Opus Dei member?
Yes. Although I should point out, we have a lot of people who come to our activities who are not Catholic, and we are the first institution in the Catholic Church to be allowed by the Vatican to have what we call cooperators, who do not, they're not, they don't have to be Catholic. They don't have to be, they do not have to be Christian, and so we have many people not of our faith, who really like what we're doing, and they say, I want to help.
But they're not members.
That's correct.
They're maybe financial supporters.
Financial prayers.
Right.
Help, volunteering.
And they don't have to be Catholic.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Cooperators. This is a good segue to get into some of the titles here. I've got these written down. Numerary assistants.
Yes.
What?
They're the treasure of Opus Dei. These are women who have as their professional work the care for our centers. So they create in all of our centers a home, a real family home.
So they do all the cleaning, cooking, I don't know, whatever, house-type duties, household responsibilities.
They run the whole place.
Right.
So they do all those things.
And they're just women? A numerary assistant is only a woman?
Yes.
Okay. So if a guy said, that's really just what I want to be, I just want to serve in this way, it's just for women.
Well, you know, in the men's center, that's true, but in the men's centers that are taken care of by the numerary assistants, the men also chip out. They chip in. They do a lot of manual chores. They take care of their own bedroom, et cetera.
Right.
But our founder, who died in 1975, St. Jose Maria Escriva, as you said.
Okay.
He had this vision of things that it would be the women who, some of the women of Opus Dei, a small percentage would do this professional work.
Right. Okay. Do they pledge to celibacy as well?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. All right. Let's go to the next category. Associate Opus Dei members.
Yes.
Am I getting this right?
Absolutely.
Okay. What?
So the founders saw the basic division is the majority of people in Opus Dei would be married or heading towards marriage. And they would be with their families, obviously. Then there were those who would have a vocation to what he referred to as apostolic celibacy. Some of them would live in centers. Those are the numeraries, such as myself. There would also be some people who, because of their own personal circumstances, would continue living with their family. And so they are the associates.
These folks also pledge celibacy?
That's right.
They don't live in Opus Dei houses?
Correct.
By the way, I'm taking this list off of, I've gone to a few websites because, look, obviously you're a proponent of Opus Dei, and then our next guest, John Allen Jr., is somebody who I think is fairly objective and has written quite concisely about this, considered by many to be an expert in Opus Dei. So we're going to get him on the phone a little bit as well. But of course, there's detractors out there. So this is a good opportunity to clear up what people are saying. And, so there's some slants here. They're not my slants. I've just, pulled them off some different sites. The associate Opus Dei members, they don't live in the Opus Dei houses. They've pledged celibacy. They include people who have not acquired university degrees. Do their level of education come into play of where you're at in the membership of Opus Dei?
That can be part of it. There are some associates who have a PhD, right. Others who do not have a university degree.
But does someone's education have any role to play in, you know, what level they achieve.
That could be part of the formula.
You know what that sounds like? That sounds like if you're dumb, you're not going to go very high up in the Opus Dei thing.
No, it's more just being realistic.
Not dumb, uneducated. Sorry.
I mean, there could be farmers who are very, very intelligent people,
right,
who are associates.
Right. But a farmer would never become a supernumerary.
Well, there are tons of farmers who are supernumeraries.
Would a farmer become a numerary?
Probably not, because there would not be a center of Opus Dei near the farm.
But it has nothing to do with their lack of education?
Nope.
Okay, just checking. This is good. This is what I like. I wanted to have you on here to clear up this stuff. Numerary priests. They join Opus Dei as lay members.
That's right.
But are then handpicked by Opus Dei superiors to become priests of Opus Dei.
That's right.
Numerary priests hold the top government positions in Opus Dei.
That's right.
And many hold important positions in the Vatican.
Many, I wouldn't say many, but there are some who are there.
There are some, okay. Right. Each Opus Dei house is assigned a numerary priest.
As the chaplain.
Right, as a chaplain.
Yeah.
Whose responsibilities include saying Mass, hearing confessions, and giving spiritual direction to the Opus Dei members.
Exactly.
So that's clear?
Yeah.
Okay. Supernumerary. That is a crazy title. Do you get a cape when you get to that status? Members, those folks may, they could be married.
Yes.
And live with their families. They follow the same plan of life as the numeraries, but generally do not know about many of the details of numerary life. What does that mean?
I don't know who would have said that, but...
Because here's the concept, or the, I guess some folks out there would feel that this society, or can you call it a society? What are you, a group of people? What are you? Is it a society of people?
I would say an institution of the Catholic Church.
Okay. That you only find out stuff. You find out more stuff. Stuff is such a great word, isn't it, Tim? Stuff. I don't know why.
Stuff works everywhere for lots of stuff.
It does. The further up you go, you find out more stuff. Is that true?
No. You talk to any supernumerary, he or she knows exactly what the numeraries are doing. And it's everything's in writing. Everything has been published for years now.
Right. These folks contribute large portions of their income to Opus Dei?
They contribute whatever they want to.
Okay.
And I must say, the supernumeraries, as they develop in their vocation, they come to see Opus Dei as really a part of their family.
Right.
Because they are part of the family. So they do whatever they can to help out, and because they feel the weight of Opus Dei on their shoulders. And so there's a lot of generosity going on there.
Okay. And now, is this the top one, a numerary? Because a supernumerary sounds like it'd be above a numerary.
So my mother said. She was once talking to someone. This is back when I was a supernumerary in high school, and yeah. She talked to someone who said...
You were a supernumerary in high school? Did that help your dating life? No, I guess that's the sort.
It did.
Okay, I'm just wondering.
Like
but
this guy.
She was talking to somebody, and it was the other way around. But anyway, she said, my son's a numerary, and the other man said, well, my son's a supernumerary.
Right.
And she kind of got a little bit feisty, said, wait, put up your dukes, buddy.
Why, I oughta. Okay, so a numerary, they pledge to remain celibate.
That's right.
Generally live in Opus Dei houses.
Yep.
They commit their entire salaries to Opus Dei.
That's right.
Salaries from what?
Now, remember, 98% of Opus Dei...
Lay people.
...are all lay people, professionals, just like you.
Right.
And so they have breakfast, go to work.
It's very Hutterite. You know, it's like the Hutterite community. Everything that I make goes into the community.
Okay.
Is that fair?
I don't know.
Well, no, but I'm saying that's what a Hutterite community is. So that's what this is all about. You submit incoming and outgoing mail to your directors?
No.
That sounds a little... Huh? Has that ever happened? Do people check the mail in these Opus Dei clubs?
No.
Are you sure?
I'm absolutely positive.
Practice various forms of... Now, of course, we've got to get into the corporal mortification thing. And I guess, you know, you must be so tired of explaining this, but please bear with us because there's a lot of people that don't understand this. And this is the part of your society that's where the eyebrows get raised.
That's right.
People, you know, in this day and age, because we understand the corporal mortification has gone on for years in the Catholic Church. Years and years and years. So it's not a new phenomenon.
Right.
But what's new is that the mainstream Catholic Church has said, yeah, we don't do that anymore, but you guys still do.
Right.
Okay? So that's where we're headed with that. So the spiky chain worn around the thigh, how do you pronounce that?
Cilice? That's right.
Use of the discipline, which is basically like taking a knotted rope, like macrame. mm-hmm. and smacking your back or your backside.
Right.
This is awkward now. I'm getting awkward. Because I'm going to ask you, do you smack your butt with a knotted piece of macrame?
Once a week.
Really? And you got the chain thing on your leg right now?
No.
Yeah, 2 hours a day, is it?
That's it.
Except not on Sundays.
You've done your work.
I try to do my work. I only work one day a week, so I better do it. During those 2 hours, do you pull away from society so that you're not an irritating jerk because you got this thing strapped to your leg? Do you kind of sit down for the 2 hours and just read scripture? Is it a certain time period, or do you just go? How do you choose the 2 hours is what I'm trying to ask.
I just pick 2 hours where I'm just going to be in my office. So I'm there sitting, working, chipping away at the computer, just normal stuff.
Yeah.
This is not a big deal. So.
Well, it is to everyone else because we don't do that kind of, there's nothing, the closest that the rest of the Jesus people, the rest of the world doesn't get this at all, but the other Jesus people that are out there, maybe the evangelicals or whatever, the closest they come to getting this is fasting, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to give up food for 24 hours, or we're going to give up chocolate or sex or TV or drugs. I don't know. Whatever. Depends who you're talking to. So we understand the concept of fasting so that when you have those hunger pains then drive your thoughts towards God and maybe the sacrifice Christ has done.
Exactly. For, it.
Right?
That's exactly the same thing.
But dude, this is... Sorry, I just called you dude.
Father
dude.
But
this is... this is, people would say, well, this is extreme. This is going to the extreme. let me clear this up to our listeners. It's not like the scene in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, the movie. You're not whipping yourself till you're bloody.
Right.
Correct?
Oh, yeah.
And if anybody does do that, you'd hope their supervisor would go, lighten up.
That's exactly it.
Okay. The steel clampy thing looks very similar to what they used in the movie, but it's not tightened to the point where your leg is dripping with blood.
Correct.
It's not piercing the skin.
Correct.
It's just meant as an irritant.
Exactly.
Kind of like a flank strap on a bucking horse.
That's right. Never thought of that image, but right.
Which the Hutterites use.
That's right. Okay. All right. Have we cleared up all the different... is there another position in the Opus Dei crowd here that we're missing?
That's it.
Okay. Thank you for clearing all this up. I really appreciate this.
I should say, by the way, Drew, that this recent book published by the secretary of John Paul II pointed out, this is 6 months ago, that John Paul II, just like previous popes, and just like Mother Teresa and others, exercised this corporal mortification.
Okay, so it's interesting when you say that, because when you say Mother Teresa performed corporal mortification on herself,
right?
People go, okay. Because we all love Mother Teresa. Everybody has it. You know, it feels good. But, you know, we look at you guys and go, really? You guys do that? That's odd.
Yeah.
Okay. What are your detractors saying about you? I mean, what are the things you're just sick and tired of having to defend all the time? Can you speak to that? Number
sure.
one thing. The
one
corporal
thing.
Mortification, do you think?
No, I think people seem to like to, they seize upon, they say, we are only interested in the elite.
You mean you're handpicking people that you think are going to really help the Opus Dei cause?
Yeah. Or the people of a certain level in society. And I always like...
That's why you've never knocked on my door.
But what I get a kick out of, I once heard of a taxi driver in some foreign capital who picked up a banker. And the banker saw the taxi driver had on his visor a prayer card, the picture of our founder.
Okay.
So the banker said... Where did you get that? I've always heard that Opus Dei is just for bankers.
Interesting.
And the taxi driver said, that's interesting. He smiled. He said, when I first came in touch with Opus Dei, I thought it was just for taxi drivers.
Okay.
So the point is, we deal with anybody who wants to listen to us, all levels of society, whether they be a bus driver, UPS driver, farmer.
Do you think that what John Allen Jr. wrote about you was fair?
John spent, if I'm not mistaken, 2 years going all over the world. John is a very careful journalist who deals only with facts, so I was really quite edified and amazed at what he came up with.
Painfully objective is how people have described him.
That's
clinically so.
Yeah.
But he did have some words of advice for you.
Thank goodness.
There were some suggestions that, have you heeded his?
Oh, yeah.
You have. Really?
Now he's a smart dude, to use your term.
I think we should get him on the line. John Allen Jr., this is Drew Marshall. How you doing?
Hey, Drew. Listen, you've described me as painfully objective, and I will at least buy the painful part. on my better days.
Speaking of corporal mortification.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for joining us. Everything that I've come across and read about you has suggested that you are, for all intents and purposes, an expert in Opus Dei, and I'm sure you might shy away from that if you have any humility at all, but this book that you wrote, Opus Dei, an objective look behind the myths and reality of the most controversial force in the Catholic Church. Why is it the most controversial force?
Well, largely through circumstances not of its own making. Opus Dei, of course, was born in the late 20s in Spain, which meant that its early development took place in the context of the Franco government and Spanish fascism. Critics over the years have liked to link Opus Dei to the kind of culture of the church militant that national Catholicism developed under Franco. The other sort of genetic fact about Opus Dei is that in its early years it was frequently sort of seen as a kind of rival to the Jesuits in Spain, which meant that there was a kind of built-in sense of at times friendly and at times not so friendly rivalry between those two forces in the church. And then, of course, in the period after the Second Vatican Council, Opus Dei, I think, again, without any intention on its part, got swept into the politics of left versus right in the Catholic Church that so often have kind of defined the terms of debate. And that, of course, brings us to the Da Vinci Code and Dan Brown and sort of the perfect storm of publicity surrounding Opus Dei, on the back of that episode. And so you wrap all of that up together. It's no particular surprise that over the decades, Opus Dei has often been a lightning rod for controversy, although I think most observers of the Catholic landscape today would say that a lot of that controversy has died down.
Okay. This is the first time that John, you, and Fred have been together on a show talking about Opus Dei. Am I correct in this?
I think that's correct, although I do so much media. I hate to, never say never, as
right.
they say, but I think that's right. Yeah.
Okay, well, Fred has agreed to this as well. So I'd like to introduce the two of you, although you have met before, yes?
That's right.
Yes, we have.
Okay. Some, John, have suggested that your book, although quite objective, was a bit of a soft ball in regards to taking a look at Opus Dei. And so I maybe would like to get you to speak to what some would say, that Opus Dei is a culture which demands aggressive recruiting, especially at the numerary level, the withholding of information from new recruits and new members, the imposition of intense coercion and guilt on those who wish to make free decisions, and blind obedience to superiors, as the founder of Opus Dei commands in Maxim 941. So what do you say to those claims?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of loaded words in those claims,
yeah.
Right? I mean, intense obedience, blind obedience, aggressive recruiting. I mean, all of those are sort of eye-of-the-beholder things.
Yes.
Certainly, I think there are enough people in enough parts of the world that have experienced those things, that is, who will say that they felt they were subjected to overly aggressive recruiting, or who would say that they felt that the expectations of submission to authority were too strong, that I think you have to take those reports seriously. Two things I would say about them is that for every one person you can find, and they certainly are out there, who will tell you those things, there are probably an additional 10 members of Opus Dei who will say they never experienced anything like that in their lives.
Right. So we're talking about people who've had a bad experience and have shouted from the rooftops about their bad experience.
Yeah, and I think this is part of the trajectory of any new reality in the life of the Catholic Church, whether it was the Dominicans and the Franciscans in the 13th century, the Jesuits in the 16th century, or the new movements in the 20th century. They tend to get born in a kind of fit of enthusiasm, and that's a wonderful thing in terms of setting their members on fire with the faith, but it also can sometimes be a little overwhelming and a little suffocating.
Okay.
And then there's some maturity that has to go on. I think that's as true of Opus Dei as it is of anything else. The other thing I would say is that to the extent that there have been charges of overly aggressive recruiting, of sort of robotic control of members and so forth, I mean, by now those charges, I think most people would concede, are a little dated. You typically hear people who were members of Opus Dei in, say, the 40s, 50s, and 60s making those kinds of charges. It's much more rare to hear them today.
Okay, the corporal mortification, let's dive into this. I'm sure you're both quite tired of this conversation, but this is new for us, so let's go there again. the Silas, is it pronounced Silas? The discipline, of course, the knotted rope whipping. There's some other ones here, and I need you to give me yes or no on this stuff. Cold showers. Most numeraries take cold showers every day and offer it up for the intentions of the current prelate. Is that correct?
That's right.
Really?
Yeah.
See, that part right there, I'm out. I'm done. Cold showers
mess
me up.
Me too, Drew, let me just say.
Meals. Numeraries generally practice one small corporal mortification at every meal, such as drinking coffee without milk or sugar, not buttering one's toast, skipping dessert, not taking seconds, or maybe eating broccoli. I just threw that in. For the most part, eating between meals is not practiced. Opus Dei members fast on the church's prescribed days for fasting, but otherwise must ask for permission to fast on their own. Is this all true, Fred?
Yeah, I mean, I would nuance it, but why slow things down? Sure.
Okay, all right. Well said. And here's this is one that I don't know, struck me as a little odd as well. The heroic minute. Well,
that's a great one.
Come on.
I pound away at that with kids like you wouldn't believe, because you have to be able to get up when the alarm clock goes off. And it drives me crazy to see kids.
Snooze button.
Young people who are in their 20s who are still incapable of getting up.
Folks, the heroic minute. Numeraries are encouraged to jump out of bed and kiss the floor as soon as the door is knocked in the morning. As they kiss, they say serviam, which is Latin for I will serve.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yep, although they use their own alarm clock.
Oh, I see. So there's no door knocking.
That's right.
So there's no snooze button in Opus Dei?
No.
Okay. John, am I right for having a kind of a head tilt moment here? You know what? Just to one side.
If your point is that a lot of these practices are countercultural, that is, they're things that not very many people do.
Right.
Sure, that's the case. If your point is that they sort of bespeak a kind of informal Marine Corps ethic in Opus Dei, you know, that they're looking for the best and the brightest, people who were really committed, particularly among the numerais. Of course, that's true. And let me say that as part of the research for this book, I had originally planned to spend a week living in an Opus Dei center in Barcelona just to get a sense of, the nature of the life.
But the cold,
I made it
the
about
cold showers.
Before I checked into a hotel. So I'm going to the Holiday Inn because, you know, in addition to all the other stuff that you just ticked off, I was doing this in Spain where people, and the Opus Dei people reflect this, typically have dinner at 10 o'clock at night and then think nothing of having an hour-long meeting afterwards. So this is insane, you know? if your point is that there is a kind of expectation of the thorough quest for holiness and for walking the talk, that's certainly true, and it's certainly the kind of thing that most people are going to find potentially a bit excessive, if not a little bit odd. But that doesn't make any of the practices you just ticked off definitionally wrong,
okay,
or dangerous or negative.
Let's quote the founder, all right? Blessed be pain, loved be pain, sanctified be pain, glorified be pain. That's from The Way. I'm thinking about that in terms of the freedom of being in Christ these days and not being bound to legalism. And I have another head tilt moment. John?
I think Fred will probably be in a better position to answer
Fred?
That. I mean, the way that they gloss that language about pain is this is not an exaltation of pain for its own sake, or the notion that one ought to, you know, on a routine basis, seek unnecessary suffering. It's rather the notion that, you know, the old saying, in everybody's life, a little rain will fall. That is, you know, try as we might, we're never going to fully avoid suffering. And seeing from the theology of the cross, the notion of redemptive participations in the suffering of Christ, suffering can be meaningful. And these practices that you just ticked off are not so much sought for their own sake, but they're sort of daily symbolic reminders of that broader point, that all of our suffering in some way is a participation in Christ's redemption of the world, which, in it, you know, taken in moderation, I think, is a healthy idea. Pressed too far, it can become dangerous.
Fred?
You know, the founder wrote those words when he was in the hospital at the bedside of someone dying of tuberculosis back in the 30s. And what he was trying to do with this person was to help her to instead of being focused inward, kind of collapsing in on herself, to realize, okay, this is a key moment for you to transform that suffering of tuberculosis into something of being united to the sufferings of Christ and become a great thing.
We're running out of time, so let me just quickly run over a couple of things. And again, I want to thank both of you for joining us, because in order to get to the bottom of things, I mean, look, obviously, Fred, you're going to go rah-rah Opus Dei. And John, you're bringing to this discussion a balanced view, for all intents and purposes, painfully so, as many have said. But there are those out there online and everywhere else that maybe say, you know what, I've had a bad experience with Opus Dei, and so I need to bring these forward to you both to hear what you have to say. And, of course, your objectivity, John, is much appreciated. Reading material, is that restricted or controlled in any way? Fred?
You know, if someone is going to read something that could have implications with regard to morals, with regard to the faith...
What about stuff that speaks out against Opus Dei? Can they read that?
Sure. Now, what they'll do is they will ask someone who has experience with this, can I read this? And when I do read it, can you offer something that will help me to evaluate what's going on between the lines of this thing? Because if people read something and they don't have the proper preparation, well, they could end up losing their vocation, losing their faith. You know, who knows what could happen? And it has happened in history, many different people.
Do you discourage your members from confessing to non-Opus Dei priests?
We say to them, you can go to confession to anybody you want to. But if you want to get advice from someone who has been brought up in the spirituality of Opus Dei, you'll be smart to go to a priest of Opus Dei.
And the practical reality, Fred, wouldn't you agree, is that most Opus Dei members routinely would make confessions to Opus Dei priests?
Absolutely.
Well, that's because he happens to be handy. I mean, he's in the house. You got one right there. You don't have to get on the bike and go down the street to Father What's-His-Face.
But also because he wants to receive advice from someone who's doing exactly the same thing he is.
Well, sure, and in that sense, it's worth saying that this is no different than lay members of, say, the Third Order Franciscans making Franciscan priests their confessors. It's not just Opus that does this kind of thing.
Right. John, did you feel at all that there was too much control of the Opus Dei members by the Opus Dei superiors?
Well, look, there was way too much structure for me, I'll tell you that.
I mean,
I'm an only child. I'm used to making my own decisions about my time and my space.
Enough said. I don't want
someone telling me when to pray and when to eat and so on. But the one thing I would say is that structure, which I found, again, far too top-heavy, the Opus Dei members I met seemed to have freely assented to it and seemed to find it meaningful and positive and in helping them to flourish. So it's not my cup of tea, but I certainly didn't find it imposed upon anyone.
All right. You made some recommendations in your book to help Opus Dei, I don't know, pull their head in, move in the right direction. Are they following your recommendations, John?
Well, some places more than others. Certainly the business about transparency, I think the way that they responded to the Da Vinci Code episode speaks to that. I think in many ways... In a relatively short arc of time, Opus Dei went from having one of the worst communications operations in the church to having one of the best, and that, of course, it's because it's been galvanized by crises culminating with the Da Vinci Code thing. I think they made a corporate commitment to transparency, and that worked to their benefit. I've also suggested they ought to, solicit opportunities to work and play well with others in the church, and I think that is happening in fits and starts. It happens in some parts of the world more than others, and at some levels more than others.
I know this is going to be painfully hard for you to answer in a yes or no question, John, but here we go. Have they become more transparent, yes or no?
Yes.
Have they begun to collaborate with other religious orders, yes or no?
B+.
Okay. And its members should air out in public their criticism of the institution. Are they better at that, yes or no?
C+.
Okay. Interesting. Boys, thank you. I very much appreciate this. You are both very respected in what you do. The people that I've talked to in my little gossip circle have given you both check marks and A+. So I really appreciate both of your time. John, thank you for phoning in. Well, us
Great
phoning
pleasure,
in.
Great pleasure, Drew.
Take care.
Bye.
And Father Fred, you got to get on the train and then over to Porter Airlines and back to Montreal.
Yes, sir.
No Cadillac for you. Oh, that's right. You're not Pentecostal. Sorry. Sorry. I forgot about that.
That's great.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Drew.
It really has. And everything John Moore said about you is spot on. You are a genuine cat. So I'm not sure whether he actually said that or not, but that's what I'm saying.
No, he's the one who said dude.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. My apologies for that blunder. Folks, a short break. When we come back... We're moving from Opus Dei to some pretty hardcore rock. Brian Head Welch. He is the Grammy-winning recording artist, formerly of Korn. What a story this guy has. Wasted pretty much 2 years of his life every day on meth. and then somehow pulled out of it and surrendered his life to God. It's a bit of a glory story, but it's a real trippy one, let me tell you. Up next, Head from Korn. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.